Hello, and welcome to the World of Power Hour, your friendly neighborhood philosophy podcast, coming to you live from 19th century continental Europe. I am Josef Schiff.
I'm Alex Altman.
I'm Jimmy Harrison.
If you're unfamiliar with how our podcast works, we spend the first few minutes of each episode reviewing a different craft beer, and we spend the remainder drinking that beer whilst we wax philosophical. Each episode revolves around a particular question or text, and today's question is, what does it mean to live aesthetically, and is such a life desirable? We'll begin our discussion with an overview of Friedrich Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy from the Spirit of Music, followed by a brief discussion of his concept of eternal recurrence, as discussed in his most famous work, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. We'll then proceed to discuss Soren Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, which is not, and I repeat, not one of those really weird messed up seduction guides. It's kind of sexist, but it's definitely not a seduction guide.
Messed up in its own way.
Yeah, so before we begin, just a few disclaimers. First, we strive for only the highest in academic integrity. That said, we hereby absolve ourselves of any and all responsibility for any inaccurate statements or erroneous attributions. Second, we are purveyors of wisdom. And we believe that the truest truths are found at the bottom of six packs and large format bottles. The more we slur our speech, the more truth you are hearing. Third, and most importantly, don't take us too seriously. We certainly don't. So today's beer is actually a very appropriate beer for our podcast, as you will come to hear a little bit later. We're drinking Midas Touch by Dogfish Head Brewing Company. It's a, it's a handcrafted ancient ale with barley, honey, white muscat grapes, and saffron. So I guess the story is they found this remnants of beer, chemical remnants of a beer within the tomb of King Midas, and they recreated the recipe and sell the beer for $12 for a four-pack. It's 9% out. Beer Advocate...
I thought it said salmon at first. I'm like, I'm not sure I want to drink this.
Yeah, no, there's no salmon in the beer, don't worry. Beer Advocate says this, it has a rating of 84, so pretty good. It says the sweet yet dry beer is made with ingredients found in 2,700-year-old drinking vessels from the tomb of King Midas. Somewhere between wine and mead, Midas will please the Chardonnay and beer drinker alike. So I guess has a nice, clear golden color. It's not really that hazy. It's pretty clear.
It's pretty typical.
Yeah, it's kind of aromatic. Yeah, it's definitely very sweet.
Not so
hoppy, much more on the malty side.
It's
like a beer, not like a mead or a wine or something like that. So that's interesting. Given that
I really taste that those grapes in there though. It's strange to me.
Yeah,
this is definitely a heavy flavor.
Yeah, and it's very sweet.
Yeah,
yeah, definitely different from a lot of the beers I drink. I tend to gravitate more towards the hoppy beers.
Well, yeah, no, I have because any malty beverage, even the nicer ones, they still kind of remind me of malt liquor itself, So it's hard to shake that association.
Yeah, I see what you mean. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, do you like it?
Well, again, it's with the maltiness, it's hard for me to get into personally, but I mean, it's definitely not as bad as, I didn't mean to associate it with malt liquor too, aggressively.
Yeah. I think I like it because it's different. Not my favorite beer, but it's very different.
I like that it's got the history in it.
Yeah. And it's also, again, as we'll see, it's very appropriate to our podcast.
Most depressing quote ever.
Yeah, super depressing. Very Schopenhauerian, actually. Yeah, well, I guess let's get into it.
Did you just make an adjective out of Schopenhauer?
Yeah, Schopenhauerian.
Okay.
Makes sense to me. Does it not make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. It just seems a little unwieldy.
Yeah. It is an unwieldy name. Got some unwieldy sideburns.
Did he?
Yeah, huge sideburns.
Button shop style?
Yeah,
or just...
yeah, and they like kind of flared outwards. I think it's the picture that's on Wikipedia of him, actually. Arthur Schopenhauer, who we talked about in our last episode. I guess let's get into it. So we're going to talk about Birth of Tragedy first, and then we're going to move through Nietzsche and then go into Kierkegaard. We mentioned Birth of Tragedy a little bit in passing on our last episode. It was Nietzsche's first published work. It was when he was a professor at, I believe it was the University of Basel. He was actually like the youngest chair of the department or youngest full professor or something. I think he was 24 years old at the time. This was published in 1872. It also, unfortunately, ruined his career. People didn't really take him seriously after he published this, and eventually led to him leaving and just kind of living life off of his pension that he received from the university. The full title is A Birth of Tragedy Out of the Spirit of Music, and it's about a number of related topics concerning, I guess you could say, culture and art. In it, Nietzsche views the rise and fall of cultures through the lens of art, and he discusses at great length why, for him, the ancient Greeks were so awesome and why the modern Germans, aka 19th century Germans, suck so much. It comes down to his theory of tragedy and the interplay of what he calls the Apollonian and Dionysian artistic drives. The book also addresses the problem of modernity, the problem of life, and it asks the question, is life worth living? Nietzsche's answer is ultimately, no, life is not worth living, but we can learn to live with this knowledge through tragic art. A little bit depressing, but not quite to the same level as Schopenhauer. You know, Schopenhauer kind of thought that we should live our life as ascetics, not aesthetics with a TH, but ascetics. You know, just kind of living as, you know, Buddhist monks almost, negating our drives and our desires. Nietzsche wasn't as pessimistic as Schopenhauer. So the question is, you know, what's so special about ancient Greek tragedy or Attic tragedy? Attica was the area surrounding ancient 5th century BC Athens. So it's just referred to as Attic tragedy. What's so special about Attic tragedy? For Nietzsche, Attic tragedy was the pinnacle of art because it struck the best possible balance between the Apollonian and the Dionysian drives. So what the hell does that mean? What are these two drives? The Apollonian, you know, back in the old days, 2,500 years ago.
The good old days.
The good old days. great times.
That's actually a good point. They bring up good times because, well, actually it was such bad times that they needed to, you know, that's where the Apollonian, you know, forces come from, right? That, like, desire to keep the...
Right. It's a desire to address the suffering of life. So he said that the Greeks were these people of supreme sensitivity, and they were living in these what are ultimately pretty shitty times. You know, there's, you know, a lot of death, disease, destruction, warfare, all that stuff. And they were very acutely aware of the suffering of life. They experienced what today we might call existential angst, maybe a little bit different, but roughly speaking, it's kind of existential angst. Like, why is there all this suffering in life? How can I possibly live any kind of meaningful life? I'm just this like little speck.
Why are we here?
Why are we here? And why are we being cursed? That kind of thing. So Nietzsche's term for this, for existential angst, for the problem of life, he called it the wisdom of Silenus. And this gets to our beer. You remember the story of King Midas? He was the guy who wished that everything he touched would turn to gold. And he accidentally turned his daughter into gold because he gave her a hug and apparently forgot that everything he touched turned to gold. So,
fathers should never hug daughters.
What'd you say?
I said fathers should never hug daughters. That's the moral of the story.
I think that's the moral of the story, is that you shouldn't have daughters. Exactly. So this isn't that story, but involves the same guy. I'm gonna actually read this quote. It's from section 3 of The Birth of Tragedy and describes what he's talking about, the wisdom of Silenus, the problem of life. Again, this is section 3. He says, an ancient legend recounts how King Midas hunted long in the forest for the wise Silenus, companion of Dionysus, but failed to catch him. When Silenus had finally fallen into his hands, the king asks, what is the best and most excellent thing for human beings? Stiff and unmoving, the demon remains silent until, forced by the king to speak, he finally breaks out in shrill laughter and says, wretched ephemeral race, children of chance and tribulation, why do you force me to tell you the very thing which it would be most profitable for you not to hear? The very best thing is utterly beyond your reach, not to have been born, not to be, to be nothing. However, the second best thing for you is to die soon. So, well, kind of a depressing quote.
Well, that just sounds like a total dick.
Well, you know,
it'd be better if you'd never been born, but at the very least, you died soon.
Hey, we all relate to Bohemian Rhapsody, right?
Yeah, great song.
Sometimes I wish I'd never been born at all.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a good point. That kind of sentiment is reflected in a lot of popular culture, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody, a lot of other pieces of music. And, you know, he's talking about the problem of life. Again, this existential angst. Why am I here? You know, this, you know, potentially the realization that all of your values, even potentially your morality, is not really based on anything. There's no metaphysical core to any of this. Life is empty. It's meaningless. It's full of suffering. Nietzsche said that the Greeks really felt this problem very deeply, and they came up with a way of dealing with it. And it was through the creation of very profoundly beautiful representative art that Nietzsche says is epitomized by the Olympian gods. They were these amazingly beautiful figures, and it was in the form of everything from soaring statues to exciting literature, such as Homer's The Odyssey. All this beauty and all this aesthetic wonder, I guess, was a way to deal with the wisdom of Silenus, that existential angst that plagued them. It's a bulwark against suffering. It's a distraction. And this is what we mean by Apollonian art. So why is it called Apollonian? Well, Apollo was the ancient Greek god of the sun. He represents light and beauty and form. Apollonian art, the kind of art that's focused on beauty and on form and structure, it's structured. It's analogous to Schopenhauer's, you may remember this from last time, it's analogous to Schopenhauer's Principium Individuationis, or the principle of individuation.
Wait, we talked about that last time?
I think we mentioned it briefly.
I must have been too drunk at that point.
Yeah, we had pretty strong beer last time.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it. We might not have, but...
No, we might have. I was just super, super drunk.
If you recall, in The World is Will and Representation, Schopenhauer's argument was that the world is really two things. We have will, which is that ineffable kind of core of existence, analogous to our subjective experience of reality, and representation is appearance. And it's order that is imposed on things. But they're just two aspects of the same thing. Well, the principle of individuation is the world as representation. It's the order that we pose on things. It's the principle by which essentially we individuate objects. Like Alex and I, you know, I'm viewing us as two different objects, but there's not necessarily any reason we couldn't be considered to be one object, but that's just a structure that we've imposed on the world. This is what's represented.
I mean, we're very close friends, so we're really just one object.
We're really just one object. Cool, beautiful, slightly homoerotic object.
You said it.
Does that make sense? I mean, am I reading the Apollonian, what he means by the Apollonian correctly?
Well, certainly, I mean, I see it as like that important original force that does give some sort of form to the world. You know, like we were saying, it was an escape from just the terribleness of, you know, life, you know, the kind of primal, brutal life that they lived prior to that. So I see that.
Alex, I mean, does that sound right?
What I think the key to understanding it in the context of this work is to understand how it contrasts with Dionysian or Nisian or whatever the fuck it's called.
Yeah, and
that would be my guess. Is, you know, it seems right so far, but I would need to know what the other one is to know whether we're actually drawing a distinction that's going to help us.
I wonder, I mean, not to get ahead of ourselves, like he seems to be saying that Apollonian art is primarily like visual art, you know, things like architecture or paintings, things like that.
I think those are the prime examples of it, but remember, he also says that Homer's The Odyssey is an example.
True, true. I mean, he pretty much says, I mean, doesn't he say pretty much everything except music is, you know,
there
some kind of Apollonian art?
Yeah, and he also says there is some Apollonian music, but yeah, he holds up music as the primarily Dionysian art form, which, you know, obviously we'll get to.
So our death metal band was Dionysian, not Apollonian?
Sort of. Well, kind of. I mean, it was both. So, I mean, well, that's actually kind of an interesting point. So, well, let's get to that later. I do actually want to talk about death metal a little bit. if Alex can remind me when we talk about the Dionysian, because it's interesting that
if
you say
I'm
that.
Still
because
sober enough, I will remind you.
Yeah, because it's interesting because I think that actually can serve as a really good example to illustrate the tension that we're going to talk about between the Dionysian and Apollonian. So
who knew?
Yeah. So ultimately, if I'm reading him correctly, he says that ultimately there's a problem with purely Apollonian art. Essentially, the observer remains an observer, and you're never truly united with the art or immersed in it. You remain in quiet contemplation of it. Apollonian art is really meant to shield us from the innate suffering of the world, but it ultimately ends up falling short because it's this, you know, we kind of realize that it's just a structure we've imposed on the world. There are these beautiful forms, but there's nothing behind them. They're just those forms, and we need something more to immerse ourselves. Do you think that reading of it is correct of the problem of purely Apollonian art?
Yeah, absolutely. I see it as what came to mind just now as you're describing it is Thomas Kincaid. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy who just drew all those pictures of like those cottages and the snow and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's really pretty and, you know, real nice. And they were like, he was a best-selling artist. But, you know, it's a type of art that is sort of devoid of any real, no feeling behind it per se. Like you don't get anything more after contemplating it further.
Did you listen to the Partially Examined Life?
But I did not.
Oh, they really? That's funny. They brought up that specific example.
Oh wow!
They talked specifically about Thomas Kincaid.
Wait, but doesn't the sort of pastoral, you know, landscapes
yeah.
and stuff?
Yeah.
But those are very pretty. They make you feel good.
But I think
I don't think
it's the kind of feeling that Nietzsche would associate with the Dionysian. I think the issue with Thomas Kincaid is that it's just purely beautiful. I mean, they're pretty pictures, certainly. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with
but
pictures.
All
they
do is make
nice.
You feel good. They don't actually.
There's just nothing there.
They have
they're just
meaning behind.
Right. They're just kind of surface. You know, just pretty pictures.
Yeah, there's no reflection of that or recognition of that sort of that basic suffering in life.
Right. All right. So the Apollonian, as we said, it ends up falling short. You only get this kind of, I guess you really just get a temporary relief, a temporary reprieve or a temporary redemption from the suffering of life. And so this is sort of where the Dionysian comes in. Remember in the last episode when we talked about the will? That's what this is getting at. The Dionysian is analogous to the will, and the Apollonian is analogous to representation, or objectivity and subjectivity. So the Dionysian is the drive toward chaos. Dionysus was the Greek god of wine and intoxication. And
I'm a fan.
Yeah, we are definitely fans of wine and intoxication. Well, beer, craft beer and intoxication. They didn't really have craft beer back then.
Well, this one's kind of like a mead, so it's pretty close.
Yeah, it's wine-like.
When Nietzsche doesn't necessarily speak too well of it on its own, though.
Oh, no, yeah, and really he speaks in...
He says it's even worse on its own than, I think, Apollonian on its own.
Yeah, and I think that might be right. And at the same time, though, he also kind of holds it above the Apollonian in certain ways.
He calls it, like, the ultimate, or, you know, the witch's brew, the true witch's brew or something.
Right. Dionysus, being the god of wine and intoxication, you can think of the Dionysian state as a state of drunkenness. What happens when you get drunk? Well, we obviously get super insightful.
Oh, yeah.
But more importantly, you begin to forget yourself. You literally lose self-awareness, and you start acting as pure will. Nietzsche, he also kind of associates a state with these ancient barbaric orgiastic festivals and with sex in general, actually.
Right.
I think there was a quote somewhere.
Here, I have one where he says, I think it's section 2, here the very wildest of nature's beasts were unleashed, up to and including that repulsive mixture of sensuality and cruelty, which has always struck me as the true witch's brew.
Yeah, and it's a great quote. And I think he says... He also says something about how the Dionysian drive always ends in either, and I think the quote was, disgusting satiation or frustration.
So basically, kinky sex or blue balls?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. Yeah. Well, satisfying, happy ending or blue balls.
Like Yossi and I were talking earlier, it kind of just sounds like, I mean, he doesn't know how to give a woman an orgasm, but whatever.
Yeah, so Nietzsche, and it's interesting because Nietzsche had a very problematic sex life, we could say, or non-existent. You know, I think we talked.
Regard.
Yeah, and I think it seems to be a theme with some philosophers, but I think, so we talked a little bit about his love interest, a woman by the name of Lou Salome, in our last episode, and how he proposed to her, and she rejected him and ran off with his best friend, Paul Ray. And Nietzsche had a mental breakdown several years before he died, and we think today that he was suffering from syphilis, because what ends up happening is syphilis attacks your brain and kind of turns it into mush, and you literally go insane. And he probably got it from a brothel. But there's this kind of funny story. Nietzsche was traveling through Beirut with a tour guide, and he asked the tour guide if he knew of any places to eat. The tour guide, instead of taking him to a restaurant, took him to a brothel. Nietzsche, upon entering the brothel and realizing that it was a brothel, ran over to a piano in the corner and just started playing music.
About sex?
I don't know. It was very bizarre.
And afraid that it would be too awkward and someone would propose?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what it was, but I think it illustrates Nietzsche's relationship with music. It was a refuge. It was redemption from the world for him.
It's too bad.
I just said, I'm going to play music. Oh, that makes it all better.
Well, he didn't sin. That was the thing. Well, pre-sin.
He's in a sinful place.
Yeah.
It's too bad that he didn't live today when it's easy to listen to music while having sex. So.
Well, he lived at a time where what's interesting about this.
He never heard R. Kelly.
He never heard Trapped in a Closet.
Yeah.
And I don't think peeing on children was a thing back then.
Well, I'm sure it was, actually.
It probably was. Yeah. But what's interesting about it, remember, he lived in a time where you didn't have musical recordings. So he couldn't just sit down and listen to music. I'm curious as to whether that had any impact on the way he thought about music.
No musical recordings of any kind?
Not back then, because it was in the mid to late 1800s. I think they had the ability to record sound, but musical recording that wasn't really a thing until the early 1900s.
To record an entire symphony wasn't something they were able to do until like the 40s or 50s. Yeah, to record acoustically, like a large room like that.
Yeah. So the Dionysian, though, I mean, just to get back to this, it's this state of just chaos and forgetting yourself and becoming part of a collective, returning to what he calls the primordial unity, which sounds very mystical, but it's essentially the will that we were talking about from the last episode. And actually, so to bring back death metal into this, you can kind of think of the Dionysian as being in a mosh pit at a concert, because you just kind of like, you're just pumped up by the music. You're just acting on pure will.
Okay. I'm sort of flag on play. Mosh pits are for punk rock shows, not death metal.
Well, whatever.
But yes, at a punk rock show. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the music's just flowing through you, and you're just expressing the music, and you're not even thinking about yourself. You're not. Boundaries are being broken down between people.
I love it. I've totally been there.
It's and I've been there, and it's
a beautiful experience.
It is, and it's a fascinating experience to reflect on afterwards as well. And ultimately, the Dionysian, it's kind of equal parts ecstasy and equal parts terror. You know, it's ecstatic because of that kind of feeling you get from a mosh pit. You're running off of pure will and striving, but it's also terrifying. You lose yourself. It's kind of like the death of the individual. I mean, you really are losing yourself.
And, am I going to get my nose broken by someone randomly throwing their fist out?
Yeah, and you ultimately can't go through life in a purely Dionysian state. You couldn't just go around being drunk all the time. You couldn't just go around being in a mosh pit all the time.
Well, I can fucking try.
We can do that here.
Ruin all my dreams, why don't you?
Yeah, we can do that here on our podcast, but you know, we can't do it all the time. It just couldn't function like that. And that's why we have the Apollonian. It serves as a counterbalance to the Dionysian. They counter each other. They keep each other in tension. And this is where we get where we finally get to Attic Tragedy.
So it's sort of so, Thomas Kincaid is the counterbalance to punk rock.
Sort of, I guess, maybe.
Well, and I think it's important to mention, because I think he does think it's important that the Apollonian, like, desire comes first, because he describes, like, a kind of rising, you know, like, the Apollonian force, like, lifts you up, and it's almost like that releasing, like, once you get bored of the Apollonian forms and ideals you've created, you know, that you want to return. You have this desire, you know, this inner desire to return to the Dionysian state.
I'm not sure if that's right.
I got the sense that it was not that they occur both at the same time, but you know, it was kind of the back and forth between them that.
So here's why I don't think that's right. In Tragedy, the Dionysian came first. Tragedy grew out of the Tragic Chorus, which was essentially Dionysian. I'm not sure if it's necessary that it grew out of the other.
I thought Tragedy first started as just, what's his name, the god as the main character, and then the chorus was sort of...
No, the chorus was first. The chorus, I mean, literally, the origins of Greek tragedy, I mean, just literally, it was a chorus. And it wasn't until later that they started having actors. And the actors are Apollonian. The chorus is kind of the chorus itself is actually, and I think he talks about it, the chorus is actually kind of Apollonian itself, only because there's already a structure imposed on it, but it's coming out of the Dionysian.
Well,
but,
yeah, I agree that because it's I was probably wrong to say that Apollonian comes first, because I was sort of presuming that, I guess, the neutral state that like all mankind exists in before, you know, they have any kind of civilization whatsoever, it could be considered Dionysian. I wasn't necessarily thinking of it that
way. Okay.
Isn't that why he singles out the Greeks? Is because, you know, they were the ones to, you know, first rise up with that Apollonian desire?
I think he singled out the Greeks because he studied the Greeks. I think that's why he's talking about the Greeks. I mean, he was a philologist and, you know, concerned with Greek history and Greek culture and Greek literature, and I think that's the medium through which he was operating, and I think that's why he singled out the Greeks.
But he did say, I mean, he did say that, you know, like having some kind of civilization structure is necessary, so, you know, which they were somewhat unique in, at least in around Europe, perhaps.
Yeah.
Sorry if I got you off track.
No, I'm just trying to think. I mean, it's The thing about Nietzsche, it's hard to organize what he's talking about into a step-by-step systematic argument.
Yeah.
I'm just kind of trying to think of where to go from here. I mean, I guess I could just say, you know, you can find some kind of salvation in either Dionysus or Apollo. You need the other one as well. Like, in the case of Dionysus, you need Apollo to reveal the essence of Dionysus through representation and appearance. You need some kind of structure. And you need some kind of wall against falling into this purely Dionysian state. From Apollo, you need Dionysus and the Dionysian in order to experience, you know, the terror and ecstasy of the will, of the what he calls, again, the primordial unity. So the Tragic Chorus...
I'm sorry, could you rephrase that in terms of beer and music?
Beer and music. You need... Well, maybe not so much beer and music, but beer and podcasting.
Okay.
So you need the podcast to give structure to the feelings induced by the beer. Otherwise, we're just kind of running around naked, flailing around and running into shit and just being drunk. So you need some kind of structure for that.
I see.
from the other from the point of view,
shot of beer per minute, that brings structure to the drinking.
Right, it brings structure to the drinking. It gives it it gives it order, and it gives it beauty too. You can have this kind of beauty to a podcast, to a structure,
to a
power hour. From the other, flip the perspective around, from the point of view of the podcast, you know, you could have a podcast, but unless it's fueled by, you know, this inner will, this striving, this hunger, this sexual desire, unless it's fueled by all
of that. Control yourself, Yossi.
Sorry. Unless it's fueled by all of that, it might kind of seem pretty, but it doesn't really have much substance to it. And that's kind of the way to think about the tension that's created between the Apollonian and the Dionysian. You need both.
Okay, and so the podcast is Apollonian and the drinking is Dionysian?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think of it. And that's sort of analogous to Greek tragedy. He saw Greek tragedy as being the epitome of art because he viewed it as striking the best possible balance between the Apollonian and the Dionysian.
One thing I was thinking of, I don't know if I wanted to take up time on the podcast with this, but it's funny that there's a phrase that Nietzsche uses a lot in The Birth of Tragedy. He uses ecstatic vision. That's actually a name of a psychedelic rock band I've been listening to lately. They just released an album called Sonic Praise.
Huh.
Yeah, I don't know if their name is supposed to be a Nietzsche reference, but...
Actually, have you seen Little Miss Sunshine?
Yeah, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah, do you remember the kid?
Yeah, the kid with the Nietzsche poster in his room.
Yeah, he was a Nietzsche scholar. He's taking a vow of silence because of Friedrich Nietzsche. Steve Carell played the world's preeminent Proust scholar, which we'll actually talk a little bit about Proust a little bit later. You know, how plausible is Nietzsche's, do you think Nietzsche's theory of art is? I mean, about these two competing drives. I mean, one thing that I'm wondering, the Greeks never really, you know, they didn't talk about artistic creation through the medium of Dionysus and Apollo. They talked about artistic creation through the medium of the Muses.
Yeah, that's, you're absolutely right.
I'm wondering how plausible this is. I mean, is it just Nietzsche's own idiosyncratic reading of Greek history and Greek literature? I mean,
I think it's another thing where, you know, it's kind of like with the first part of Genealogy of Morals, you know, the kind of history that Nietzsche was using is definitely not, you know, as fleshed out as a history that we're conscious of now, you know, in modern times. And, you know, and it was definitely, like, just being conveniently, you kind of have to accept his narrative to, you know, just understand what he's talking about at all. You know, he's definitely molding it to his own ends, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, can we get back to the whole Greeks being awesome back then?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so it's got to be so awesome. All right, so when I was working at the public defender's office, there was this prosecutor, we were discussing some case, or someone did something really just awful to their body to pass a drug test, right? And this guy's just like, heroin had better be awesome. Because, you know, I mean, like, all the shit that people do to keep doing heroin, like, it better be that awesome. And it just makes me think, Greece must have been that awesome. if it's that good that you need tragedy just to make it feel real.
Greece sounds like shooting up with heroin. Ancient Greek tragedy is like a heroin trip.
Why do we have tragedies, you know, still in art, you know, like why do, again, I, you know.
No, but that's so drugs and alcohol is like the Dionysian.
Right.
You're
okay.
Forgetting yourself. In the case of a drug trip, I'm not sure if there would be any kind of Apollonian counterbalance to it. It might be what he was talking about, the danger of. No, it wouldn't be the withdrawal, though. I mean, I think that would kind of be almost analogous to what Nietzsche viewed as the problem of living in a purely Dionysian context. It would almost be like a drug trip, like a heroin trip, where you go really hard and then you crash.
So, like, jail time, that's the Apollonian?
I guess, or, you know, dying.
Have you guys ever seen...
Yeah, way to bring it to a dark place.
No, but, like, you can't be in a Dionysian state all the time. You just can't do it. Like, I think that's... That's what he's talking about. It's dangerous. The Dionysian is terrifying. It's dangerous, but at the same time, it's ecstatic, just like some kind of drug trip. You know?
Have you guys seen Natural Born Killers?
No, I haven't.
Oh. Well, I think that would almost be a good example of what you're talking about now, because like the first half of the movie is marked where, you know, they're just this couple is going on this like love fueled, you know, murder rampage. Mostly of people who are like, you know, the audience would be sympathetic of killing. They're like, you know, really bad people, but then mistakes happen along the way, and there's this big sort of come down scene in the middle of the movie, you know, where they're, you know, suddenly realizing the consequences of their actions, and, you know, it's like, hey, killing tons of people might have some consequences, as fun as it may be.
Well, then they start killing people who are not so, you know, who are more sympathetic.
Oh, no, the targets are, like, unsympathetic to the... So the audience is sympathetic to the main characters themselves.
But they get in trouble because they just get, what, they get caught, or they just...
Well, they end up killing some innocent people, you know, who, like...
I see. So they kill some people who aren't as evil.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of...
I knew it. Yeah.
Kind of like Boondock Saints, but not with, like, a religious overtone.
Wait a minute, when did they kill anyone who was innocent?
Oh, no, Boondock Saints didn't kill anyone innocent. I was just saying, killers is kind of like, it's a more drug-fueled Boondock Saints.
Do you think we've exhausted tragedy at this point?
Yeah, let's move on to Vision and the Riddle.
Yeah, so the other...
Matthew McConaughey time.
Yeah, Matt McConaughey time. So I haven't seen True Detective, but I did see the montage of Matt McConaughey's Nietzschean-inspired, somewhat nihilistic-sounding quotes. This was really funny. But
okay.
Anyway, yeah, so the other thing we're going to talk about today, Nietzsche-wise, is two passages from perhaps his most famous work, Thus Spoke Zarathustra. Thus Spoke Zarathustra is a four-part work, and it was kind of, I guess it's, Zarathustra is almost like a Jesus-type figure for Nietzsche. It's, Zarathustra is what he refers to as his Übermensch, the overman, or superman, if you will. It's someone who is, to use Nietzschean terminology, able to affirm his eternal recurrence. So, eternal recurrence is an idea that Nietzsche presents, and the best way to describe it, I think, is thusly.
I can eternally affirm the recurrence of this podcast.
Oh,
we're awesome.
Oh yeah, we are awesome. We are much close. We are Übermenschen, much more so than the general population, I would believe.
Oh, that's pretty arrogant.
Incredibly arrogant.
It's only arrogant if you can't back it up.
Yeah, but so eternal recurrence is this idea that, and Nietzsche was really stricken with this idea. He had this epiphany while he was just on a walk. And the best way to think of it is this way: there's a finite amount of matter and energy in the universe, and an infinite amount of time, and therefore, any possible combination of matter and energy will recur forever. In other words, the particular configuration of matter and energy that exists in this room right now, where we're all sitting, where we're all doing this podcast, this will happen again and again and again for all eternity. It'll kind of like cycle through. That's the basic idea. Now that's the so-called cosmological claim, a claim about the world that it eternally recurs. And Nietzsche, you know, when he realized this, it was this terrifying thought because, you know, that means that all the really horrible things in your life are just going to keep happening over and over again for all eternity. So the Übermensch, this person, this superman, this overman, is someone who's really able to essentially deal with the knowledge that their life is going to recur infinitely forever.
So when some dick rear ends my car again,
yeah,
I'm going to have to...
Yeah.
That dick, all over again.
Yeah, that dick
eternally?
Is gonna. That dick's gonna continuously rear end your car.
You're gonna have
that
to feel
going right up that tailpipe.
You're gonna have to feel the pain of that first breakup over and over and over,
over and over again. That first time your parents catch you masturbating, you're going to repeat that over and over and over again. And he presents this idea, I think, most profoundly in, it was in part three of Thus Spoke Zarathustra in the, I believe it was the second chapter, entitled On the Vision and the Riddle. And Zarathustra goes aboard this ship with a bunch of sailors, and they're all talking and
probably drinking.
Yeah, and I think he remains silent in the presence of this crew, and he remains silent for like 2 days, and then eventually he speaks. And
don't they have to coax words out of him?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like he remained silent for like 2 days while they were coaxing him to speak. He was this, you know, mythical figure, and eventually he tells this story about how he's walking up this mountain path with a dwarf sitting on his shoulder mocking him. The dwarf says, "Sentenced to yourself and to your own stoning, O Zarathustra, far indeed have you thrown the stone, but it will fall back on yourself." The dwarf then fell silent, and eventually a feeling of courage made Zarathustra stop and speak. "Stop, dwarf, it is I or you, but I am the stronger of us two. You do not know my abysmal thought, that you could not bear." Zarathustra then tells the dwarf of his abysmal thought. "Must not whatever can happen have happened? Have been done, have passed by before? And if everything has been there before, what do you think, dwarf, of this moment? Must not this gateway too have been there before? And are not all things knotted together so firmly that this moment draws after it all that is to come, therefore itself too? For whatever can walk in this long lane out there too, it must walk once more. And the slow spider which crawls in the moonlight, and the moonlight itself, and I and you in the gateway, whispering together, whispering of eternal things. Must not all of us have been there before and return and walk in that other lane out there before us in this long, dreadful lane? Must we not eternally return?" Zarathustra then heard what sounded like a dog howling in terror. And when he located the sound, he saw that it was a man, a young shepherd. And the man was writhing, gagging in spasms, and a heavy black snake hung out of his mouth. He tried in vain to tear the snake from the man's throat. Then it cried out at me, "Bite, bite its head off, bite." The man bit, spewed the head of the snake far away, and jumped, laughing. He was laughing as no human had ever laughed, and Zarathustra longed for that laughter. That longing continued to gnaw him, even as he told the story, so much so that he could hardly bear living. And I think, you know, that this story, it shows how Zarathustra himself came to realize that things eternally recur, which was his abysmal thought. And this man that he saw who jumped up was someone who bit the snake's head off. It's someone who was able to, in spite of the fact that he eternally recurs, was able to laugh. Someone who was able to affirm eternal recurrence. Sorry, I'm a little drunk right now. He was okay with the fact that everything, all the cheap, detestable parts of the world would eternally recur, and Zarathustra himself longed for that. And I think that's, you know, an amplification of the problem of life, right? So the problem of life being the fact that we realize that, you know, we're just these insignificant little biochemical blobs on the earth that are just going to extinguish ourselves within a few decades. And what's the point of living, and all of everything that we believe is just kind of not really based on anything. This is an amplification of that, because we're going to have to come to that realization over and over and over again for all eternity. And Nietzsche was concerned about, like, how do you counteract that knowledge? How do you do that? How do you come to terms with it? And I think ultimately, I think his answer is living aesthetically, because remember what we talked about last time with the will to power. It seemed like the creation of art, and I think after we talked about the birth of tragedy, perhaps the creation of tragic art is really the only way to solve the problem of life and to affirm your eternal recurrence. Does that sound plausible?
Absolutely, because, you know, this was sort of necessary for him after, you know, Nietzsche's declaration of the death of God, you know, because he is he is a moral nihilist, you know, in the sense that, you know, he does not believe there is such any objective morality. You know, there isn't some good way to live, objectively anyway. And, you know, there's no afterlife to reward it. So, you know, the way to live is a way that you could bear to live over and over for yourself, you know, like because conscience is definitely a recurring theme with Nietzsche. And I think that's, you know, what he talks about is like having good conscience with yourself, you know, that you could bear to live your own life, you know, again, into eternity. So I think it's a necessary part of, you know, other parts of his philosophy.
So there's another much shorter passage from Zarathustra. It was actually earlier in part two. It was called On Redemption. Just real quickly, it says, to redeem those who lived in the past and to recreate all it was into thus I willed it, that alone I should call redemption. Willing liberates. But what is it that puts even the liberator himself in fetters? It was. That is the name of the will's gnashing of teeth and most secret melancholy. Powerless against what has been done, he is an angry spectator of all that has passed. The will cannot will backwards, and that he cannot break time and time's covetousness, that is the will's loneliest melancholy. So it's this idea that, like, yeah, like, all these cheap, detestable things about our lives have to recur, but it's just, like, the fact that all the crap that you've done in the past, you can't change it. And so you have to somehow accept that as part of redeeming yourself from the problem of life.
I mean, it's a common theme, you know, I think even in self-help books, you know, where they tell people, you know, that you have to accept, you know, who you are and, like, where you've gotten up to this point in life. I think that's what he's concerned with, you know, is just, like, you know, making life tolerable. You have to get to some state where you accept, you still have a chance to become, as long as you're alive anyway, you still have a chance to, like, become something great and make it, you know, all the misery in the past worth it.
And actually, we'll mention this later, but I think that particular passage is actually goes to what Nietzsche means by living aesthetically. I mean, when you're talking about willing backwards, I think he views the Übermensch as someone who can, in a sense, create their own past, can retrospectively will themselves to do things, to justify their life as it is now based on everything that has happened. So create this coherent storyline, if you will. And we'll
masters of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, kind of. I think it's probably best if we leave Nietzsche for now and go to Kierkegaard. Is that okay with you guys?
That's okay with
you. Do you guys have anything to add?
Not on Nietzsche.
Not at the moment.
Okay. So we're going to shift gears a little bit and talk about Kierkegaard. So Soren Kierkegaard was born, he wasn't exactly a contemporary of Kierkegaard. He was alive while Kierkegaard was alive, but
who was alive when Kierkegaard was alive?
Kierkegaard.
Was there any evidence that
Kierkegaard was alive?
Sorry, I misspoke. Sorry, Kierkegaard was alive when Nietzsche was alive, sort of.
Okay.
There was a little bit of an overlap. So Kierkegaard came a little bit earlier. Kierkegaard.
No, what you said was definitely true. Kierkegaard was definitely alive.
That is, in logic circles, that is what we call an analytic truth.
Is there any evidence that either of them read the other?
So, yeah, I'll get to that a little bit. I'd always hoped that one of them had read the other, and unfortunately neither of them did. They were connected through a mutual friend, but they never actually read each other's work. So Kierkegaard came much earlier. He never could have read Nietzsche's work, but Nietzsche could have read his work, unfortunately never did. Kierkegaard was born on May 5th, 1813 in Copenhagen, Denmark. And he died on November 11th, 1855 at the age of 42, about a month after collapsing on the street. No one really knows how he died. We just know that he collapsed. Kierkegaard is considered to be one of the two fathers of existentialism, the other one being Friedrich Nietzsche, who, as we said earlier, came a little bit later in the second half of the 19th century. However, unlike Nietzsche, Kierkegaard was a very prolific Christian writer. He was heavily critical, however, of the Danish church, And in fact, he was critical of any kind of religious organization. He thought that the very idea of a congregation was not conducive to discovering truth, truth with a capital T, which he viewed as this kind of subjective inward process that would ultimately lead you, if you're smart enough, to Jesus. In fact, this is the crazy part. He not only thought that despair, which is a technical term for him that roughly means the same thing as existential angst, he not only thought that despair resulted from unsound thinking, but he actually thought that if you claim to be happy, but you haven't accepted Christ, then you're not really happy. You're just a liar. You're a dirty, filthy liar. He really believed this.
He sounds a little bit like early colonial Americans, actually, at least in terms of the emphasis on, you know, the individual relationship with God.
Yeah, it was this very subjective individual process that, he thought would eventually lead you to an acceptance of Christ. So, and Kierkegaard, I mean, just alone is just a fascinating figure. And he was, again, a very prolific writer. He wrote a lot of things. We're just going to talk about one of those works. So we're going to talk about The Seducer's Diary, which appeared in a larger work called Either Or. Either Or was published in two volumes in 1843, and part one, which contains The Seducer's Diary, is a portrayal of the aesthetic mode of existence, whereas part two is a portrayal of the ethical mode. For Kierkegaard, there are three spheres of existence, or three stages on life's way: the aesthetic, the ethical, and the religious. They're basically three different ways of living. You can kind of think of them as three different ways of approaching the problem of life. And ultimately, Kierkegaard thinks that neither the aesthetic nor the ethical mode provides a real solution to the problem of life, or the problem of despair, to use his terminology, and that the religious life is the only life capable of overcoming despair. There actually isn't a part three. Instead, his religious writings appear first as a sermon at the end of Either Or, as well as in separate works. Sorry, were you going to say something, Jimmy?
I was just saying it sounds a lot like Kant.
In what way?
In terms of, you know, that there's no happiness without, you know, the religious sort of ascetic being anyway.
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with that part of Kant. I've never really heard of Kant.
Kant was, yeah, extremely ascetic. I mean, he didn't believe in, like, joyful happiness. He believed in very...
He was so against masturbation, he thought it was worse than suicide.
When he was against divorce, you know, no matter how, like, miserable your marriage was, you know, that, you know, it defied the categorical imperative, so...
Like many of Kierkegaard's works, Either Or was written under a pseudonym. He named the author, the editor, Victor Eremita. And the book is a collection of supposedly found papers. Again, it's a work of fiction, so it's a collection of supposedly found papers. And part one is a collection of the aesthete's papers, and part two is a series of letters written by the ethical person to the aesthete. And the aesthete is never actually named. He's just referred to as A the aesthete. However, the ethical person is a judge by the name of William. Now, we're only going to talk about The Seducer's Diary again, which is a portion of part one. In the preface to Either Or part one, this gets a little bit complicated, so just stick with me. In the preface to Either Or part one, Victor Eremita states how he came across this collection of papers. It's this weird, kind of long, convoluted story about how he was in town and he went by this store and he bought...
Was obsessed!
Yeah, he was obsessed with this writing desk that he found. And he bought the desk, he brought it back to his house, and sometime later, he went into a rage.
Well, he had an excuse. He was in a hurry.
I don't remember what happened exactly.
There was a stagecoach that was waiting for him, and it's, you know, beeping his horn.
Yeah, there's something in there.
Oh, I'm going to go!
Yeah, so
there was this
incident, anyway. things were happening, and he went into this rage, and he smashed the desk to pieces with a hatchet, and he discovered this hidden compartment that popped open, and it contained all these papers. What's interesting about The Seducer's Diary, which was among the papers, is that it wasn't actually written by A. the aesthete. Instead, the diary actually belonged to a man whom A called Johannes. In other words, we're like 10 levels deep now with pseudonyms. And this is something that Kierkegaard just did. He wrote in pseudonyms. And to just clarify, Aramita is the editor of Either Or. Part one is a set of papers written by A, and the Seducer's Diary is a copy of a diary written by another fictional character named Johannes. So the diary is written by Johannes, copied down by A, and found by Victor Aramita. Get it? So yeah.
Don't they call this a method of like creating these fictional characters and having them converse with one another called it's meiotic? Am I getting?
Maybe, I don't know. I was thinking multiple personality disorder.
The introduction of the copy that I read, you know, said it was, you know, derived from his love of Socrates, you know, and the Socratic.
So that's an interesting thing about Kierkegaard, and we might talk about this later, and not this podcast, but another podcast. He was very, very, very heavily influenced by Socrates. His master's thesis was on Socratic irony, and he viewed himself as a modern-day Socrates in the sense that he went around being a dick and just questioned everybody. So,
Socrates brought to the table, buddies.
Well, it was a negative philosophy, negative in the sense of, you know, not, you know, realizing the limits of knowledge. So actually, so just to repeat, the diary was written by Johannes, copied down by A, and found by Victor Aramita. Okay.
Oh, dude, it was all fucking Kierkegaard.
Well,
all right.
So hold on. There's another theory though that Johannes himself is actually really A, but he was so horrified by his past and what's revealed in the Seducer's Diary that he needed a way to distance himself from it. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And some people think that he's actually really just Kierkegaard, and that it wasn't really fiction as much as it was like a kind of confession.
Yeah, for what it's worth, there is a lot of evidence that it relates to Kierkegaard's actual life.
Yeah.
Given that it's like maps on perfectly to his autobiography. Yeah.
Well, and I guess, okay, so
I think even character names, like there are coincidences about.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, Alex, do you want to give us a summary of what of the story itself, the Seducer's Diary?
Okay.
What is it? What
so
happens?
The Seducer's Diary is the seducer, Johannes, decides he wants to, I don't know how to say it, sort of seduce.
That's a good word.
But not in the classical sense of get her in bed, but in the lesser usage of lead her along until they're engaged and then get her to break it off and enjoy all the fun.
So not like having sex with her. Not at all.
His enjoyment is much before that. His enjoyment is much more in the sort of witty repartee and the sort of manipulation rather than the actual sexual enjoyment. He spends a great deal of time, I suppose in modern terms we'd call it stalking.
Yeah.
Stalking her and other people, but mostly her. And so he stalks her for a while and finds out about her, where she lives, know what she does, what her parents do, and that sort of thing. Apparently, she lives with her aunt, and so he sort of insinuates himself into her life gradually, and coaches a young man to be her suitor. And so this poor guy Edward is basically set up to fail because Johannes is sort of coaching him on how to get in good with what's her name?
Cordelia.
Yeah, that's right, Cordelia.
Cordelia Wall,
yes. And knowing that he's eventually going to shove Edward out and take her for himself. So he sort of ingratiates himself with Cordelia's aunt. And eventually it gets to the point where the aunt is just totally infatuated with him. Loves him. And Edward and Cordelia are, you know, going along pretty well. But then he arranges things such that something gets in the way. So he basically proposes to Cordelia out of nowhere. Like, they've never so much as had more than a passing conversation. And he proposes to her after just, you know, manipulating her surroundings and the relationships around her until he's pretty sure she'll either say yes or, you know, something good. So what she eventually does, which surprises him a little bit, but not, you know, not too much. She says, well, I gotta ask my auntie, whatever her name is. You know, I gotta make sure it's okay with her. And, you know, Johannes is like, yeah, that works, fine. Because the aunt is obviously in love with him, so she's not going to say no. And, so that works. So now they're engaged. Out of nowhere. They barely know each other. But he's been stalking her for months and months, and, you know. So he knows a lot about her, and he's been arranging the books that Edward lent her. So he knows what she's been reading. And so he's basically been orchestrating a large conspiracy to try and control her life. And it sort of culminates in this proposal, which eventually the aunt gives the okay. And so she says yes. And so now they're engaged. I don't think he ever gives her a ring. They never actually do anything beyond talking and sitting in the same room.
Yeah, they never have sex, ever.
No sex. Nothing interesting.
Well, plenty of interesting things.
Well, I mean, nothing that would be, you know,
To the modern, you know, listener.
Nothing that would get an R rating, put it that way. So, eventually, he sort of arranges things. He sort of pushes her to become more independent, more
aesthetically developed.
You could call it. Well, whatever. Anyway, more assertive to the point where she realizes she doesn't actually want him, and she pushes him away and ends the engagement. It ends with her calling off the engagement and him sending, sort of enjoying the moment. Which is weird, because you'd think that wouldn't be a very enjoyable moment, but apparently it's what he lives for. So my take on Johannes is he's basically some sort of a psychopath. Not in the sense of like axe murderer psychopath, not like that. Like, he's not like killing people. I mean it in the sense that he is sort of callous, he manipulates people, he's glib, you know, all he does is manipulate the people around him. He lies without remorse. He lies to Edward, saying that he's trying to help him get in with Cordelia. He lies to the aunt, saying that he actually cares about whatever random crap she likes talking about. He lies to Cordelia about how much he, whatever, loves her, whatever he feels. He lies to everyone around him. He manipulates Edward masterfully to sort of be the patsy in his plot. And after the proposal, he spins it to Edward as if the aunt proposed that he should marry Cordelia and that he had merely accepted that. And that, oh, dude, Edward, I'm sorry, man. It's not my fault. She wanted me to, so I said yes. But dude, totally. If she'd rather have you, it's all yours, man.
You know how I'm thinking of the relationship between Johannes and Edward?
Yeah,
it's like a Harry Kim, Tom Paris kind of.
Got to bring in the Star Trek Voyager, huh?
I don't know. Tom Paris was never that much of a dick. I mean, he was a dick,
true.
But he was not that much.
He wasn't
of
that
a
much
dick.
Of a dick, but. At the same time, Harry Kim was definitely that much of a little bitch. I hate Harry Kim. I'm sorry, I just need to use this time to vent. He's a little bitch. It's just like, oh, I don't know how to talk to women. I'm a delicate little flower.
Look, without Harry Kim, you'd have no one for Tom Paris to help, and you would have no one to reveal his brilliance.
I just hope Voyager gets better.
It does. I assure you, I've seen the entire series. It does. It does get better, especially when 709 shows up. That's pretty awesome.
All right.
I absolutely agree. Because
she's basically like this weird, I don't know, autistic character.
At risk of nerding out too hard, Voyager's a great series, but that is absolutely not the correct reason. And
what are you objecting to?
No, because 709, I mean, 709, first of all, she's clearly added to the show for sex appeal, and then...
I'm sorry, that is bullshit.
No, Voyager was suffering from bad ratings, and they insert a sexy character. I can't help but be suspicious. But and then what you're talking about, too, is, like, you know, she's kind of like a cheap version of Spock, you know? Like, she had the same character arc as him, you know, where it's like, in Data, you know, learning to be human.
Anyway, but getting back to... So Johannes manipulated everyone into falling into his web of deceit, and eventually manipulated Cordelia into rejecting him, which you would think that you would not want someone to do, but he wanted that to happen. But even after she started to reject him, he sent her letters asking, you know, like pleading with her to, you know, change her mind, knowing that she wouldn't. I mean, it's just absolutely classic pathological liar.
Well, psychopathic.
Who manipulates everyone around him.
Yeah, and
has no remorse about it at all.
The definition, I think, you know, clinically of a psychopath is truly, you know, someone who sees, you know, all people around them as, you know, stepping stones to, like, their own ambition.
Yeah.
And they have absolutely no recognition.
He sees other people as people. He sees them as means to his end.
So I think this is an important point. Because remember, what Kierkegaard's doing here, he's trying to show why he ultimately thinks the aesthetic life is not a good way of solving the problem of life. It's that you can't really live this way. And there are a number of reasons for that. You know, one, you could potentially become this seedy character, this morally corrupt character like Johannes the Seducer. Two, you know, what does he do? He seeks more and more stimulation. Eventually, he's just going to get bored and restless, and it's going to be more and more stimulation. You just can't get that much stimulation.
And then that's one thing about psychopaths. They seek stimulation
obsessively,
and that is one of the reasons why they have such a high rate of drug abuse, suicide, and thrill seeking,
and
because they can't not have something exciting happen.
Right, and I think what this is showing is that Kierkegaard is saying you cannot, that the aesthetic life is not one you can live. And he's using
without
the seducer.
Something like a monster. Basically.
Right, or at the very least, you know, even if you don't necessarily become a monster, it's still very possible.
Yeah, and it's very unpleasant.
It's, you know, this was his way of rebutting the idea of the aesthetic life. That's how I'm reading it.
I do feel like he may be slightly guilty of, you know, making maybe a scarecrow argument in some ways, because I do feel like the aesthetic life he's describing is a lot different than Nietzsche's, because especially if we take Nietzsche's idea of eternal recurrence, you know, there's no way Nietzsche would, you know, agree with, like, this lifestyle that ultimately results in, like, this emptiness and frustration and this constant pursuit of, you know, something you can never have.
So there is this really interesting paper. It's by Alexander Nehamas. I think he's at Princeton.
He wrote about Nietzsche a lot. I've definitely heard that name before.
Yeah, he was a Nietzsche scholar. He basically argued, and I mentioned that we'd be talking about Proust a little bit. He talked about it, so his paper is called The Eternal Recurrence, and he likened the Übermensch to someone who lived life as if it were a perfect story, a la Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. So there's this really interesting passage.
I'd like to break in real quick and point out that I have now completed my power hour.
Congratulations. Cheers.
Cheers.
Alex has completed a legitimate power hour, which neither Jimmy nor I have done.
or even
what does that mean? I don't even know what it is.
You don't even know what a power hour is. It's a shot of beer. That's like an ounce or an ounce and a half to an ounce and a half of beer every minute for 1 hour. Power hour.
I thought a power hour was like something to do. It was like a show on CNBC.
No, I don't think CNBC has shows about that.
Well, you know, like that. It's like one of those Wall Street, you know, stockbroker shows.
Wait, what's the guy's name? Is it John Kramer? Something Kramer.
What's his name?
You know who I'm talking about.
Jim Kramer.
Jim Kramer.
Jim Kramer.
Yeah, Jim Kramer.
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Him doing power hour while doing stock tips.
Oh, yeah.
He will be slightly more crazy.
Bye!
Bye, 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 bye! Anyway, so in this paper, Nehama's, to get back to rigorous analytic philosophy, not analytic, rigorous
sure,
philosophy.
Sure, it's a Ukrainian junk bond. It can't possibly go up anymore. It's already gone to 0.
So Nehama's wrote this paper, and he likened the life of an Ubermensch to a kind of perfect story, similar to Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. There is this quote: "One might perhaps try to think of this ideal life as a frame in which different particular lives might fit and require independent arguments for excluding some of these. I do not know how one might do this, and Nietzsche does not seem interested in this approach. Still, in thinking of his ideal life on the model of a story, we would do well to think of it in terms of Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. In this fictional autobiography, the narrator relates in enormous detail all the silly, insignificant, pointless, accidental, sometimes awful things he did in his rambling efforts to become a writer. He relates the time he wasted, the acquaintances he made, the values he accepted at different times, his changes of mind, the ways he treated his family, his lovers and servants, the disjointed and often unflattering motives out of which he acted most of the time. Yet all of these somehow finally enabled him to become a writer. They enabled him to see all as parts of a unified pattern, the result of which is his determination to begin writing his first book. This book, he tells us, will relate all the silly, insignificant, pointless, accidental, sometimes awful things he did in his rambling efforts to become a writer and to begin writing his first book, which he has not yet begun, but which his readers have just finished reading. I'm not suggesting that Marcel's actual life would have been Nietzsche's own ideal, but it does seem to me that the frame supplied by this perfect novel, which relates what becomes and is seen to be a perfect life, and which keeps turning back upon itself endlessly, is the best possible model for the eternal recurrence. To achieve such a life involves a reinterpretation of what is, in a sense, already there, since the whole self is implicit in every action. Nietzsche seems to think that to lead an ideal life is to understand what the self is, which is already there, and live according to that understanding. If this is so, we might finally be in a position to understand one of Zarathustra's most puzzling descriptions. For that is what I am through and through, reeling, reeling in, raising up, raising a razor, cultivator and disciplinarian, who once counseled himself, not for nothing, become who you are. And in this way, we may be able to see the eternal recurrence, located now at the very center of Nietzsche's thought, as a provocative and serious theory of human personality." So he seems to be saying that Nietzsche sees the Ubermensch as someone who has lived as someone who is the model of a perfect literary character. But here's the thing. A perfect literary character could be a completely morally repugnant person, such as the seducer. And remember, Nietzsche was an amoralist. He did not think we should live our lives morally for the sake of living them morally. You know, morality was not something to be followed for the sake of itself. And it seems like really his perfect life was an aesthetically pleasurable. So it's almost as if the seducer, in Kierkegaard's The Seducer's Diary, is the perfect example of the Ubermensch. And it's almost as if the seducer himself shows why Nietzsche's Ubermensch is ultimately problematic. I mean, I'm almost siding with Kierkegaard on this one. If you're going to value your life purely aesthetically, you might have some lives that could be moral, that could be considered to be, you know, morally upstanding lives, but you have to invite the possibility of these morally repugnant lives.
Well,
if you're going to live aesthetically.
They're far more likely to have it.
But wait a minute. Oh, I mean, didn't Kierkegaard, though, say that even, for Johannes, his life was subjectively, you know, miserable? Like, it was ultimately miserable for him?
Yeah, he's showing the problem of living that way. He's saying, like, I think ultimately the reason it was subjectively miserable for him was because he couldn't get enough stimulation. He couldn't fight the boredom.
Well, sure, but I would never – I don't think Nietzsche would – say that the solution, like, that living aesthetically involves just, like, something as simple as just, honestly, what I thought of when I was reading about Johannes, his ambition in life seemed so simplistic in some ways. You know, it didn't have a lot of depth. Like, it reminded me of, I don't know if you guys played The Sims much, but more recent versions of The Sims, you know, they include something called life ambitions for, like, different personality types.
Uh-huh.
And one of the personality types is a romantic type, and it's like something like, oh, you know, they call sex woohoo in The Sims. And woohoo. And it's
woohoo.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And,
woohoo.
And their life ambition, like one of, you know, a handful of possible life ambitions is, you know, woohoo with at least 20 other Sims over the course of his lifetime. And I mean, and I don't think Nietzsche would ever think that, like, having such a simplistic ambition, you know, like, I don't think he would agree that Johannes lived, you know, aesthetically well.
Why?
Well, again, because he ended up miserable himself.
But could that be the consequence of living aesthetically? And I guess also, how are we going to connect this with the Apple end in the 90s? It seems like when we were talking about Johannes, he's like kind of – he's always trying to strike this balance between really experiencing erotic love and then at the same time observing himself as experiencing erotic love.
Well, certainly, but I think he has a short-term, like, aesthetic view. You know, like he's getting caught up in things because Nietzsche, again, like – he rejects, like, the barbarian, you know, Dionysian, you know,
but
way of life.
Barbarian Dionysian would be more akin for Kierkegaard to a Johnny type of character, someone who's seducing for the purposes of sex.
Well, perhaps, but I mean, you know, there's not much more to it if he's just, like, his only ambition is to repeat this seduction process over and over. Like, whether it's mental or physical, you know, there's not a whole lot there, and I think with eternal recurrence, Nietzsche is most certainly taking a long view of life. You know, he's not saying, you know, like, live in the moment and just do whatever you want. You know, because I think, you know, he would consider a life where you, like, you drove yourself into the ground by, like, pursuing some desire in your mind incessantly like that to the point where, like, it loses all meaning. I would think that he would consider that, you know, life poorly lived.
Not to get us like off track or anything, but I kind of found this interesting. Nietzsche talked about Lord Byron as being the one person who is truly the poet of his life. Seems like an Übermensch. I don't know a whole lot about Lord Byron. I mean, I know he was an English poet. What's interesting, and the connection I'm making here is kind of interesting. Lord Byron...
I thought he hated Englishmen. That's odd.
Oh, did he? I don't know. I think he hated everyone except the ancient Greeks, honestly. I mean, he hated Germans, and he was German, but...
I think he liked Mongolians, too.
Probably.
Well, he liked Buddhists, didn't he? Love Buddhists?
Yeah, well, yes and no.
We respected them
They were too ascetic. Ascetic, not aesthetic with the TH, but ascetic, life-denying. But
still, he kind of dig their stuff.
In a sense, he liked the fact that they realized you know, that life is ultimately meaningless. I don't think he agreed with their solution to it. But in any event, he viewed Lord Byron as the poet of his life. And what's kind of interesting is that Lord Byron was actually friends with Percy Shelley, who was the future husband of Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein. He was actually the impetus for Frankenstein. They would get together and... Lord Byron.
Oh.
Lord Byron, Percy Shelley, and Mary Wollstonecraft would actually get together and tell ghost stories. Well, they would tell stories, and one particular day, Lord Byron challenged everyone to write the scariest story they possibly could, and that was actually the impetus for Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. If you ever read Frankenstein, it's a phenomenal book. It's not at all what you think of when you think of Frankenstein. You think of these really hokey Hollywood movies, and you also kind of think of Gene Wilder and Young Frankenstein. Which is awesome, but Frankenstein itself is actually a phenomenal book. And I guess I'm curious what Nietzsche would think just generally of the horror genre. Here's what I'm thinking. He talks about the terror, well, the ecstasy and the terror, equal parts ecstasy, equal parts terror, of the Dionysian. And I'm thinking that the terror that a horror movie or a horror book would induce in you isn't really Dionysian terror. I'm thinking it's too individualized. So, like, you have, you know, stories about, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, I think it's the terror that's induced is too individualized. It's more about, it's not really this existential terror. It's really just more terror about, like, oh, being cut up by a chainsaw would be really painful and I would die. Like, it's too individualized to really be good, solid, Dionysian-influenced tragic art.
If I were going to compare it to a movie, I would think of Apocalypse Now. Are you guys familiar with Apocalypse Now and Marlon Brando muttering the horror?
No, I haven't seen it, no.
Oh, God, no, yes, you got to see it. Because I think it, in some ways it does reflect, because Marlon Brando plays this military colonel that, like, goes crazy in Cambodia, like, during the Vietnam War. And Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen is sent out. He's the main character in the movie. He's sent out to go find this, like, colonel that's gone AWOL. And he finds him deep in the jungles of Cambodia leading this cult of Cambodian natives.
I mean, who hasn't been?
Yeah, you know, like, we've all been there.
Really? Yeah. All the Cambodian natives, you know, for some reason or another.
But when he's muttering the horror, like, he's talking to Martin Sheen when Martin Sheen finally finds him about, like, things he's seen, like, the levels of suffering and, you know, and he represents that kind of, like, downfall from, like, because, you know, Marlon Brando's character was supposedly a civilized soldier, but he becomes this, like, too encapsulated in, like, the tragedy around him, you know, that he sees, and he goes too far, you know, he becomes psychotic and, you know, gets mad with power. If you have not seen Apocalypse Now, you absolutely must.
I think I will. I guess ultimately, so who do you think is right? Like, do you think, is the aesthetic life really a good response to the problem of life? I mean, who do you think has the upper hand here, Nietzsche or Kierkegaard? I'm actually almost leaning towards Kierkegaard here. I don't see how you could have the kind of creative energy to really come up with an illusion that's strong enough to overcome the problem of life aesthetically. I feel like you have to have... I mean, because Kierkegaard is saying that, no, the aesthetic life can't get you the kind of redemption that you need from the suffering of the world. Ultimately, Kierkegaard said it can't even be an ethical life. It has to be a religious life. But he's just saying that the aesthetic life is too empty. You're always going to be seeking more and more stimulation. And on top of that, not only are you going to be seeking more and more stimulation, you also have this problem of you're allowing these ethically dubious people, these ethically dubious lives. You're allowing this to happen. And I'm kind of almost siding with Kierkegaard on this. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, can you have the kind of creative energy that's sustainable to really solve the problem of life? Can you live aesthetically? Is that really the answer to the problem of life?
I will agree with Kierkegaard on that point. I would just like to – may I rant now? Is it okay
for me? Dude, you can –
I have a specific rant that
go
I would
for
like
it,
to
man.
Okay,
rant,
so
– rant away.
So Kierkegaard is a terrible writer. His reading The Seducer's Diary was like watching Paranormal Activity 4. And if you've ever seen that movie, you know that about 90% of it is just filler. Literally, the movie is about 15 minutes of action, you know, with you know, maybe a dozen legitimately funny moments and like a handful of legitimately scary ones, packaged around about an hour of footage of a home in which nothing's happening. Just empty rooms in which no one is moving. It's literally, the filmmakers just had surveillance cameras in empty rooms using, like, you know, night vision technology to take video of the room in which nothing was happening for, like, an hour of the movie. Paranormal Activity 4 would have been an awesome movie if it had been, like, a 15-minute YouTube video. That would have been golden! But they didn't. They put in an hour of filler in which nothing fucking happened. I just object to his writing being so florid and full of bullshit.
Oh, okay.
I mean, good God, man. Here is one sentence. I'm going to read one sentence that Kierkegaard wrote in The Seducer's Diary. Okay. She fights with the arrows of her eyes, with the command of her brow, with the secretness of her forehead, with the eloquence of her bosom, with the dangerous enticements of her embrace, with the appeal of her lips, with the smile of her cheeks, with the sweet longing of her... Holy shit, Kierkegaard! Could you finish a fucking sentence, man?
Hey.
Good God!
Alex actually reminds me, there was a part in there where he describes the different sounds a kiss makes. It just made me want to puke.
But I think that's partially his point.
Gets much worse.
But no, I think that's partially his point. He's like going into detail, like how the aesthetic person thinks, and he's like, this is a problem.
I could describe, no, listen, I could describe a kiss aesthetically way, way sexier than he did. I do have a response, though. Like, I want to just reiterate, I think I have sort of said this, but I still think that Nietzsche's doctrine of eternal recurrence responds to those problems, you know, that because I believe he's implying that, you know, in order for eternal recurrence to be tolerable, you know, your life kind of has to justify itself by the very end, you know, like I'm incorporating other things I know about his philosophy about that, you know, his idea of constantly becoming and that you don't become what you are until you have died. So I think, you know, he believes, like, when he's talking about eternal recurrence, that he's saying you have to end it on a high note, more or less. Like, you have to die without regrets, because, like, it's death with regrets that is, you know, the life that's not worth living. And again, I don't think that Nietzsche would say that Johannes in The Seducer's Diary, you know, is an Übermensch. I just feel like Kierkegaard has this almost shallow view of, like, what it means to live aesthetically. You know, like, he doesn't quite appreciate art as deeply as Nietzsche does.
You think you necessarily... Because I kind of agree that you kind of have to give up the idea that, like, if you're going to judge a life aesthetically, you kind of have to do away with the idea of judging it ethically. In other words, you could have an ethically seedy person live an aesthetically perfect life. Do you agree with it? Because remember, Nietzsche didn't like morality.
When I think that it's something that we're getting more and more in touch with in pop culture today, with you know, the types of, I mean, there's all these anti-heroes that populate TV shows now. You know, like we get
anti-heroes doesn't mean that they're amoral. It just means
they're like, I mean, I'm thinking like Dexter, you know, and then again, True Detective.
Well, Dexter was arguably, you could consider him a sociopath, but he had a moral code of sorts.
Well, it was entirely subjective, though. I know that Nietzsche would have no, like a subjective moral code, you know, I mean.
He seemed to view what he was doing almost artistically, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like.
Well, Dexter didn't have limits. I mean, there were things that he would not do because he could not do evil things that evil.
He had a subjective code, but it's not like he believed that he was going to be rewarded in some way, you know, like after death.
Oh,
I mean,
you have to believe that you're going to be rewarded for your ethics to matter? I mean,
well, he lived a life, like, I mean, I think this is what Nietzsche was talking about in terms of eternal recurrence. Like, you live a life that is tolerable to yourself, you know, that you could, you know, like, that's what would make you embrace eternal recurrence. Is like, hey, I'm happy with the life I lived. You know, I don't have any regrets. I can deal with that.
I'm all with not having regrets. I get that. That sounds like a good idea. I just don't see how that contradicts what Kierkegaard is saying.
Well, it doesn't. Well, I mean, because the character that he created in Johannes did have regrets. Or, I mean, he seemed to suggest that Johannes was ultimately unhappy in some way. I mean, unless Johannes was unhappy, I mean, like, why wouldn't you do what he did?
Well, no, maybe he did what he did because he wanted to experience those things, and that's what made him happy.
Well, sure, but and that's why I would say, like, that's a misunderstanding of living aesthetically.
Well,
you know,
what do you mean?
Well, because, like, that sounds too much like just living impulsively.
Well, no. I mean, look, if he's living for the purpose of experiencing these certain things, and he experiences them, then he has no regrets because he's accomplished his goals, and he could recur if he's accomplished what he wants to. He's lived the life he wants to live, so he would gladly do it again. No?
I don't know. I mean, it seemed to me.
Well, I don't know. What
like, especially when you read the preface, the introduction to Seducer's Diary. I mean, he basically says that the Seducer, you know, is kind of this person who could never find enough stimulation, and he needed greater and greater amounts of stimulation, and he just couldn't get it. He just couldn't find it, and he would become restless and full of existential angst that he couldn't really combat aesthetically. And I feel like, yeah, I mean, I don't know how you would have the kind of creative energy throughout your entire life to live that way.
Well, sure, and I mean, and that's why I think that Nietzsche would disagree that that's aesthetic at all.
I think he would say that it is aesthetic, but I think that it illustrates the problem.
Like, I think Nietzsche would say that that person's being dishonest about themselves, about what, you know, they're actually seeking after. Again, I mean, I think that's why he believes there has to be a balance. It can't be entirely well, I guess both Apollonian and Dionysian are ultimately aesthetic ways of living. But I mean, because I just don't understand, like, how else do you judge a good life other than was the person who lived it content at the end?
Yeah,
you know,
well,
like,
I mean, that's the question. You know, that's the question. Do you live like an ethical or religious life or something else? And I think that's kind of ultimately the question. And so next time on the World of Power Hour, your friendly neighborhood philosophy podcast, we're going to be talking about the ethics.
Zombies!
We're going to be talking about the ethics of zombie killing. It promises to be a very interesting discussion. And we will see you next time. Thank you so much for listening.